Coming up on Weekend America.
Galveston, Texas is underwater. Shards of glass in downtown Houston. Hurricane Ike is spreading its intensity through Texas. We go to Austin's mayor in this hour to hear how they're handling evacuees 3 years after they took in folks fleeing Katrina and Rita. I'm John Moe. Also this hour, a Somali refugee was running for his life and only had time to pack a song.
You are running away. You are escaping for your life. It's kind of running and singing. You don't know where to go. That's how the song came over.
On the run and keeping music in your heart. And we all love a good nature documentary, but what happens when you love them too much?
If I'm enjoying seeing these things that these animals do and thinking, ladybugs do the things that I feel compelled to do.
Grab a bowl of aphids and join us for Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Like you, we are continuing to monitor developments in Texas, where Hurricane Ike has hit and hit hard. Millions are without power, and it will be a while before we have an accurate idea of the devastation caused by the storm. After making landfall in Galveston, Texas, Ike was traveling north through Houston onto Dallas with heavy rains, tornadoes, flooding. It's having an impact on all of Texas, of course, including the state capital of Austin. We're joined by the mayor of Austin, Will Wynn. Mayor Wynn, you have multiple shelters and thousands of people from Galveston in Austin. How does that intake process work?
Well, I'm pleased that 2 years ago I signed a letter of understanding of interlocal agreement with the city of Galveston for Austin to specifically be their point-to-point evacuation destination. And so there's been good communication now for a couple of years planning how the city of Galveston would even get to Austin than what we would do with folks once they're here. We have about 25 shelters open right now, about 7,000 folks in these shelters. Most of these are school gymnasiums, and as one begins to fill up, then we open up the next sort of school down the same corridor. We have electronic billboards and signage on the major highways from the southeastern part of our state where most folks are driving in from. Now that the storm has hit, frankly, the actual evacuation has, of course, virtually stopped. We took in thousands of folks over the last 2 days or so, including a bunch of medical special need folks. We got all the folks out of the hospitals in Galveston, flew them here to our local hospitals, and then we also evacuated folks out of private nursing home facilities, elderly, handicapped folks, and we have those in special need shelter at our convention center downtown right now.
Well, we associate those of us in other parts of the country remembering Katrina, for instance, we remember a lot of pandemonium. How orderly has this evacuation, especially from Galveston to Austin, gone?
It's gone very well. I'm very, very pleased. Actually, 3 years ago with Katrina, and then followed 3 weeks later with Rita, Austin, frankly, we had a remarkably positive experience. We flew the last 5,000 people out of New Orleans on planes directly to our convention center and literally the last 5,000 folks out of New Orleans that weekend 3 years ago. And this community rallied, and we had a remarkably positive experience with that. And we've learned a lot since then. The interagency communication truly is impressive. In 2004, the city of Austin spent about $50 million. We built a new emergency operations center. We call it CTEC, Combined Transportation Emergency and Communication Center. 60 different agencies are housed there right now, 24/7, in the same big room with hundreds of live video feeds and computer screens. I think the interagency communication is the big story of this evacuation plan compared to the last three or four.
Is that in a response to how poorly things went last time?
Well, to some degree, yes. I mean, sadly, good news, bad news, we're getting practiced at this. We still have folks in Austin from Gustav. We flew folks out of private nursing homes in New Orleans 2 weeks ago, and they're still with us. We've been able to place them in private nursing homes here in Austin because their facilities still aren't ready to take them back in New Orleans. But we're getting practiced at this, and the frankly, the federal government wasn't there for us for Katrina, and they have been these last two major events, Gustav 2 weeks ago and Ike today.
What's been the biggest challenge this time around?
Well, it's always, ultimately, it's communication to the folks as they are entering your town, the actual evacuees. And so, you know, many of them don't know, you know, the call letters for the appropriate, you know, AM or FM radio stations that we're using, you know, that kind of thing. They don't have good maps of the city.
Right.
So we're utilizing a bunch of electronic billboards along our two major highways that enter Austin from the southeast, and that's helped a lot. You know, the media plays a big, big role in this, and the media's even better practiced at it now than you all were the last couple of years. So that's a big benefit, but ultimately it's trying to get information to folks as they evacuate. And the good news about the interlocal agreement that we have, the point-to-point agreement that the city of Senate of Galveston and the city of Austin have, is that folks in Galveston, for the most part, were giving good information in advance, what to take. You know, bring some bedding, bring a pillow, bring an ice chest if you have it. If you're bringing your pet, of course, bring some pet food, that kind of thing. Whereas that information wasn't given to folks as they evacuated, even for Rita 3 years ago.
And how about personal communication? People who are in your city and have relatives in Montana or in New York, are they able to reach those people right now?
Well, many of them are. The big challenge we had with Katrina that we ultimately solved pretty quickly within the first few hours was setting up large banks of computers and telephones, you know, for folks to make contact with friends and family members somewhere else that actually could come help them, could get them off a cot on a concrete floor somewhere. And that's occurring in pretty good order right now, but this exercise is slightly different in that for the most part, the vast majority of the general population evacuees have come in their own car, they have their wallets, they have their, you know, 3 or 4 days worth of pharmaceuticals, and they have their pet food and that kind of thing, and they anticipate going back to Southeast Texas here in the next day or two. The storm's moving quite quickly. It's well inland now.
Right.
The challenge we might have here in Austin, because we did take all these medical special needs folks from Galveston very appropriately, we're proud to do it, is we are now having to plan for an extended shelter operation for folks who probably can't go back to this actual city of Galveston. It's underwater now, it's going to be for a while.
Sounds like it. Mayor Nguyen, good luck to you and good luck to the city of Austin and all the people of Texas.
Thank you, John.
Well, the presidential election is less than 2 months away now, but both the McCain and Obama campaigns are still in fundraising mode, pausing in between the handshaking and the baby kissing and the attack ad making to try to generate yet more dollars. That's just how it's done. That's the world we're living in. In recent years, the electronic fundraiser, an email pointing you to a website, for instance, has become more commonplace, but the classic fundraising formula is still practiced. You gather some people together in a hotel ballroom. You charge a seemingly exorbitant amount of money for a plate of food, $1,000, $10,000, and you make some cash. I have always wondered what gets put on the plate when the plate costs $1,000. So last fall, as the primary season was heating up, I set out to find out. Got an email from Bill Clinton the other day. He wanted me to join him to watch a debate and have some chips and soda. Then I got a follow-up from Hillary. She said Bill and I should eat carrots instead. Oh, those Clintons. They didn't really want to hang out with me, of course. They just wanted my money. The trend for campaign 2008 is clear. Folksy, friendly. I matter. But, of course, I don't really matter. I'm just one person on a blind CC list of thousands, maybe millions. I mean, it's not like I'm shelling out for one of those $1,000-a-plate fundraising dinners. But I've always wondered, if you pay $1,000 or $10,000, What do you get to eat anyway?
I'm starting out with a salad course in the beginning, accompanied by obviously some French bread or some garlic bread or what have you.
That's Colby Underwood. He's a political fundraiser for 24 candidates ranging from city council hopefuls to Hillary Clinton. He agreed to explain how one of these events works.
Followed up by maybe a chicken breast, or here in Seattle, we like to do a lot of salmon fillets, especially once in season, or seafood. And then a small dessert at the end as well.
So I'm out of grand and I'm getting chicken breast and a salad?
We want to raise as much money as possible from these events, and we want to keep the overhead low. A guest at one of these dinners or one of these lunches or what have you doesn't want to come in and see filet mignon and all these other, you know, prawns and what have you on the menu. They don't want to know that the money that they're donating or the donation that they're making is going to pay for this food that they're having.
The elites don't want to eat like elites. Okay, but do they at least get a drink?
You'll have a bar, but the guests are asked if they do want to have a drink. You know, please pay for that drink.
Now, Colby, if the wine gets flowing, if the drinks get going, people are feeling a little generous. People are feeling a little more loving to the world. I mean, have you thought about that?
Sure. I will admit I've actually seen that happen before. But we also want to be responsible. I mean, we're obviously hosting this event. We have guests coming. We are responsible for what they're doing at that event.
The candidate doesn't want a DUI attached
to
their name.
Exactly.
So you don't get steak and you don't get booze, but you definitely get Barack.
Many donors will not support a candidate or a cause unless they can be face-to-face and press the flesh with them. In order to get those folks involved, we've got to have those types of events. They will not support this candidate or this cause unless they can meet them.
And if the candidate is in one place, they can't, unlike in email, be fundraising any other place. Now, before any of this happens, of course, it has to be planned. Hotel booked, invitations printed and sent, RSVPs tallied, seating charts, a lot of things that don't directly involve money coming in. In fact, of all the forms of fundraising, the big ticket event is one of the most expensive to mount. And they need to pay for it all up front, says Jason Tyler, catering director at Seattle's Westin Hotel.
Nobody bills political parties. So any hotel I've ever known always requires payment in advance.
Why is that? Why can't you bill a political party?
Well, I think the fundamental reason is you know, candidates come and go, and you know, political events are often put on by local committees and things like that that may or may not be an established entity with any sort of, you know, funding background. So
by the time they get the bill, by the time the invoice arrives, that candidacy might not even exist anymore.
In theory, that could happen, yeah.
Expensive, inefficient, and not at all folksy. As our inboxes fill with emails that appear personal, we might be seeing the sunset of the $1,000 plate. Again, Colby Underwood.
You're seeing more direct contact, personal one-on-one meetings, a lot of personal phone calls, and a lot of what we call surrogate fundraising, where a friend of a friend may call you up and say, hey, you know, my brother Joe is running for city council, and I'm hoping that you'll take a look at his website and decide that you want to support him. As we get more and more into the future here, fundraising events are becoming more and more difficult to do.
So, in the political future, you'll have to deal with more insincere appearances of friendship from people who just want your dough. Ooh, message from Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd just came in. He wants to go to a Red Sox game with me, as if. But also in the future, chicken breasts and salad will be a lot cheaper. In Seattle, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
When you're fleeing Somalia, being chased by militia groups, you don't have time to pack anything. Except music, coming up on Weekend America. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. This year, nearly 7,000 Somalian refugees have come to the United States, more than from any other African nation. Most are fleeing the civil war. If you had to suddenly flee, what's the one thing you'd bring? That's what we've been asking America's new immigrants in our One Thing series.
I'm from Burma.
I came from Iraq.
I'm from Somalia.
I'm from Somalia, too.
I go to America.
We have carried with us
videotapes,
my dad's picture,
some very old Sunday school books.
Without your pass, you're nothing.
This weekend, we meet Omar Abdirahman. He's a Somali Bantu in Portland, Oregon. Omar and his family fled to Kenya after being targeted by militia groups. They spent 15 years in a Kenyan refugee camp. They finally made it to Portland in 2004. Omar works at a fish factory in town, but on weekend mornings, he sings while playing his drums and traditional guitar. That's the one thing Omar brought with him, his music. He and community leader Abdullah Aziz Mohammed tell us their story. Like many Somali Bantu, Omar and his family fled to Kenya after being targeted by militia groups in Somalia.
My name is Abdiaziz Mohammed. I am one of the Somali Bantu community youth.
Good morning.
Morning to you.
Good morning.
What we're going to show you today is mainly what is the Somali Bantu culture and what it's based on. We usually sing together and come up with songs. Mostly the Bantu songs, they come under situations. This kind of situation was like when the civil war started in Somalia from 1991 to 92, when the civil war broke out in Somalia. That's when the song started.
On 1992, the war broke down in the Somali country. That war is affect all the country, but especially our community, Somali Bantu.
Somali Bantu
in Somalia, there's a group called Somalia that's who are holding the power, and there is other small group like me. I am Somali Bantu. We are just people who are farming. People, they go to farming in the morning, and they come home in the evening. They just do some guitar, some song, drumming, play music.
But the Bantus were the major farmers that grow all the stuff for the government. So the government will come and use force, get like whatever you grow, by force, and you can't say anything.
Our people, Somali Bantu, was discriminated. So that's why when the war broke down, we doesn't have any minister, any political person. So the whole the system of our community was break down. My father was killed in front of me. Someone come home with a gun and shoot our dad. The next morning, one of my neighbor, he was shot and killed.
We walked 12 days. I didn't bring anything because I cannot carry anything. Everything I have, I just left it. This kind of song is mainly based on the running away from home to the refugee camps. So you're just running from Somalia to Kenya for refugee. You are running away. You are escaping for your life. It's kind of running and singing. You don't know where to go. That's how the song came over.
We spent almost 15 years in refugee camp. Even in Kenya, there is no full peace. In refugee camp in Kenya, even one day, what happened is my wife go to some places to look for food. There is a people who have a gun. They are walking around in the evening. One day, my wife go out from the refugee camp. She has been raped. and then B, the left side was broken, and up to now she's not feeling well. In refugee camp, we have a big board. The name of the refugee families, I'm printed out, and every single week they put on the board the names of the refugee and then what is the plan. So I saw my name and all my family said that, Abdirahman, your case has been approved by the United States and then you will be resettled in the United States. That's the day I start breathing even.
Actually, we have a wedding party for two community members from our Somali Bantu community. They're going to celebrate, eat food, dance, music, drum, and everything.
I'm from Somali.
I'm from Somalia too.
We're the same.
We have
like same
grandpa and grandma.
It's kind of a dream that came true, and we have been waiting it for so long, yeah.
G-G-V-A-O. Now I am in United States, and my life already changed. My kids and my family, all my economy has been changed. I get a job. The kids go to school. They already started speaking English. But I don't want them to forget our culture too. So when I have a time, I just volunteer myself to call some of the kids to show how to play guitar and our cultural dancer and then drum. We are still thinking people we left behind at the Africa refugee camp. The people are still there.
Gedio Abdi are there.
She's telling my name is Gedio Abdi. She's saying mainly I am alone here. My kids, one is in Nairobi and one is in Somali back home. And there's no chances for me to bring them over here. We sang this song for the struggle of freedom. They call it Wabala Sudnabo, means may God get to us our freedom. So we're not going to leave any kids behind, ladies, men and women, youth and elderly people even. We're not going to leave anyone behind until we all die or we get our freedom back. Anywhere you go, show that this is our culture and it can be known so that we are people that are known that we are here.
Our story was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Ola.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA program.
Ah, the North American documentary watcher, a rare and fascinating species. Hear them in their natural habitat, ahead on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and it's time for your weekend soundtrack, that song that rattles around in your head all the way from, let's say, late Friday to the very dawning of Monday, your weekend song. Maybe it's Everybody's Working for the Weekend by Loverboy. Maybe it's something else. This week's story comes from Nathan Tift, who listens to us in Edina, Minnesota on KNOW. The soundtrack to his weekend is The Heart of Saturday Night by Tom Waits, and he spoke with Bill Radke.
You gassed her and a wheel with your arm around your sweet one, your Oldsmobile, barreling down the boulevard. You're looking for the heart of Saturday night.
This sounds like a weekend soundtrack, Nathan. Why is it yours?
Well, I first heard of Tom Waits and actually first started listening to him when I worked in Antarctica, actually at Amundsen Scott South Pole Station. And we worked 12-hour shifts. I was a meteorologist, and there was one other meteorologist. So we had 12 hours on, 12 hours off. So there really weren't any weekends. And when I put this song in, it kind of reminded me of a lot of things that I had been living without when I was in Antarctica. Things like traffic and gas stations and telephones and strangers and money.
In a week, you know that this will be the Saturday you're reaching your peak. Stopping on the red, you're going on the green, cause tonight will be like nothing you've ever seen. And you're barreling down the boulevard, you're looking for the heart of Saturday night.
You can really imagine yourself cruising down any main street in the USA on a Friday or Saturday night. And it was kind of like getting in the car and going for a drive when I listened to this song.
Is it the balmy smile on the corner of her eye? Magic or the melancholy tear in your eye?
Help us picture Antarctica. What did it look like?
Well, at the South Pole, it is just incredibly barren in all directions you go. It's flat snow and horizon as far as the eye can see. And I did get the opportunity to go snowmobiling about 10 kilometers away from the station. And it's amazing being in these places that are kind of out from the South Pole, where you know that so few people have ever been, that when you're walking around, you're probably setting your foot on a place where no human has ever set their foot. And when it's 100 degrees below zero in the middle of the winter and you're walking around outside, you know there's probably not anyone else on Earth that's walking around in temperatures as cold as the temperatures you're experiencing.
Sounds like you're aching to get back, Nathan.
I would love to go back to Antarctica, absolutely.
When's that going to happen?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think it will happen. While I was down there, actually, I had a couple of seizures for some unknown reason, and now that I'm epileptic, it's unlikely that they'll let me go back. So I think that's something that kind of adds to the mystique, knowing that this is something that I did get to do once and probably won't get to do again. But I know that, and I'm really glad I got to do it, and it helps me to appreciate the things that I can do.
Stumbling onto the heart of Saturday night.
Nathan Tift of Edina, Minnesota. Thank you for sharing your weekend soundtrack, Nathan.
My pleasure.
Nathan Tift's weekend soundtrack, Tom Waits' The Heart of Saturday Night. Man, that's a beautiful song. He was talking with Bill Radke. We want to hear from you. We want to hear about your weekend soundtrack, the song that you have rattling around in your head. Just take a moment right now. You know the song, right? I bet there's a good story behind it, and if there is, we want to hear from you. We want to share that song with the world. We want to share your story with the world. We want to share you with the world. Get in touch with us and let us know your weekend soundtrack and the story behind it. It's real easy to get a hold of us. Just go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. As the weather gets chillier outside, you might be doing one last hike this weekend. Or maybe you'd just rather curl up inside and watch nature on TV.
Our planet is a blue planet. Over 70% of it is covered by the sea.
Nature documentaries, like those produced by David Attenborough, have everything. Beauty, drama, brutality, humor. But reporter Sean Cole finds nature documentary fans even more interesting than the documentaries. Sean wondered what it would sound like if David Attenborough did a program about them.
Fans of nature documentaries tend to nest in an urban setting, like this one, Brookline, Massachusetts.
That's not Sean's real voice, by the way.
Thanks for blowing it. This is Ariel Glassman's habitat. She's 25, lives with her boyfriend.
Thank you very much.
And when you see their apartment...
You know, it's Brookline and it's small, but...
It's tiny. I mean, so you can understand why she has 75 nature documentaries in her Netflix queue.
Life in the Undergrowth, National Geographic Africa, The Life of Birds, Blue Planet...
Three of those are by David Attenborough. And his latest program, Planet Earth, was running Sundays at 8 o'clock on TV, the same time as the PBS show Nature.
So my nature shows are competing with each other.
Except there's already a Planet Earth DVD.
That my boyfriend and I managed to get a Canadian copy of before the series even premiered here.
Oh my God, you had a bootleg copy.
I had a bootleg copy.
And why?
I have lived in cities or fairly dense suburban areas my whole life, and there's only so much access you get to the natural world in those places. And I think it's fantastic for me to be able to take a look at places I've never been, probably never see with my own eyes.
Why do you say you may never get to go there?
Because I can't afford to go there.
Actually, Ariel spent a lot of her childhood in Amherst, Mass. There are no tigers there, but it's really leafy and green, and she had a lot more time to frolic in the grass back then. She told me about this one time. She was with a friend, and they stumbled across a kind of hidden canyon in the woods. And, you know, for a little kid, that's like happening upon a Mayan ruin.
It taught me how striking the natural world could be, how it could just take you by surprise. It was sort of the gateway moment.
A gateway to watching nature shows on TV.
If I hadn't had those experiences, I'm not sure I'd be as interested today in, you know, what I can see on the television.
And yes, Ariel knows that sounds backwards, but it's like that moment burned a permanent question mark into her brain. And the nature shows are these little exclamation points. For example, watching Life of Mammals by David Attenborough, she felt like she wasn't so superior to other beings with hair.
It's kind of grounding because we are still in reality mammals, just like that squirrel on my tree out there.
When a squirrel finds a white acorn, it always eats it immediately, because otherwise it would soon germinate.
Ariel and I sat down to watch Life of Mammals at one point.
On the other hand, red acorns, like this one, are almost always buried as a store for winter.
And then, weeks later, when I mentioned to a completely different person that I'd seen the show, she said...
Did you see the part about the acorns?
Yeah.
Where they knew what to do with the two different kinds of acorns?
Yeah
that, I saw that one.
Really?
Yeah, it's
that
fascinating.
This is
it's
Melissa Guillaume. She once drew a picture of four ducks playing volleyball and one of a rhino having cocktails with a warthog. Right? She's an illustrator and a really big David Attenborough fan.
Tricky. I almost have a little bit of a crush on him, you know what I mean?
Her husband, who's also named David, knows this.
I mean, if I have to lose her to somebody, you know, I respect Attenborough.
For a Manhattan apartment, their place is pretty big. Though it got a little smaller last year when their daughter Holly was born.
You know, we got a 9-month-old, and I would love to go to New Zealand tomorrow, but it's not going to happen.
So David Attenborough does most of their traveling for them.
I'm on Lord Howe Island, a tiny speck of land 300 miles off the east coast of Australia.
You know, I feel like the human being has a certain, like, range of things they have to get. It's like you have to have interactions with people, and you have to sleep, and you have to play, and you have to interact with plants and animals. I don't know. I really think it's like it has to happen.
And that's the way you do it.
And I guess that's the way that we're doing it right now.
And sometimes, as though they'd just gotten back from an actual vacation, they find themselves telling their friends about the exotic places they've seen.
You know, well then, you should have seen, because then the, you know, the polar bear came out of hibernation.
It's funny, I never really thought about it, but recently I've started to think that maybe we're getting a reputation among our friends for watching kind of a weird amount of this stuff.
It's true. One of their friends told me that they could discuss this IMAX movie about beavers, quote, at great length.
One night under a full moon, Mr. Beaver, male beaver, comes over and starts kind of chattering amorously to the female beaver, and they sort of do this moonlight pas de deux where they actually rear up on their hind legs and embrace each other with their little claws and go tottering back and forth in the moonlight. And the camera sort of considerately pans right, sort of away from the little beavers or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, cut to baby beavers in Beaver Lodge.
So they didn't actually show the full-on beaver stripping.
No. It wasn't that kind of movie.
Of course, beavers aren't exactly travel-to-Africa animals.
I guess there are beavers probably within 10 miles of where we're sitting.
Donal O'Shea lives in San Jose now, but he grew up in Ireland, watching David Attenborough on the BBC. And unlike a lot of Nature Show fans, he's been all over the world. Been to South Africa a bunch of times.
And I've had the opportunity to go up to the game parks, and I've only gone once, so it's much more comfortable to sit in your living room and watch it on TV than to actually run the risk of catching malaria and all the rest of it.
I can huff and puff to the top of the mountain.
This is Ariel again.
But David Attenborough's not going to follow me all the way up in a helicopter giving me all the details about, you know, the antelope that's 20 yards to my left that I can't even see.
And this is the very simple but very important idea that kept rearing up as I talked to these folks. On TV, the animals are so close, and they're doing such interesting things. And in person, they'd be too skittish or bloodthirsty or just plain boring to sit and be awed by. But there's something even more basic that nature shows offer, something more gut level than the awe factor. And that is the awe factor.
There is definitely a cute factor. On planet Earth, there's this footage of a mother polar bear and her little babies, just as they're coming out of the hibernating den.
Her cubs gaze out at their bright new world for the very first time.
They can barely walk. They've never eaten anything other than their mother's milk.
The female calls them. But this steep slope is not the easiest place to take your first steps.
And it's just, you know, all of a sudden one of them just tumbles, you know, and it's so cute.
Which, you know, cuddling up to a polar bear would be not something that would be recommended, but to watch them is a warming feeling.
And then when the narrator says,
but they are hungry.
Unfortunately, you know, reality is cruel and the mother and the bear cubs will have to find food within a week now or they're going to starve. That's when I always start to kind of go, you know, and then when they show them tracking down the baby, like, seal pup, and you know they're going to eat it, you know? You have that moment where you're like... And actually, Dave and I have this expression. We'll say, end of seal pup, continuation of polar bear, you know? Because we have to remind ourselves that there's a good side of that story, you know?
Have you ever gotten emotional watching a nature program?
Oh, of course. Yeah, horribly. Yeah. Actually, especially after the birth of our child, I would say it's actually gotten worse.
It's funny. I remember shortly after Holly was born, there was some kind of nature show on, and I remember seeing this bird hatch out of the egg, and the parents sort of nuzzling it. And yeah, as a parent of a, you know, whatever she was, 4 weeks old or something at that time, yeah, Melissa and I just looked at each other, and we both had tears in our eyes, and. You can't help but relate to the helplessness of a baby when you're a parent, you know.
Whether it's on TV or not.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And whether it's human or not.
There's a certain kind of religious component to it, almost. You know, you're getting a view of the world, of life, of existence that is outside you and your normal experience. I mean, I'm getting a bit carried away about the whole thing now, but it just kind of forces you to recognize that by no means are you and the people around you and the human race the only things to be considered or thought about or worried about.
And if this were a David Attenborough documentary, that's probably how it would end.
We can ensure that there is still a place on Earth for birds in all their beauty and variety, if we want to. And surely we should.
Well, from documentaries to photographs, on our website, there's a little feature called America's Weekend via Flickr. It's a photo montage of snapshots that are tagged weekend and or America on the photo sharing service Flickr. Lots of pictures lately of some incredible vacations in the mountains, some summer festivals. There are some sci-fi geeks, or I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. There are fantasy enthusiasts at Dragon Con. I'm looking at it now. There's a really kind of sad bear costume kind of guy, a lot of parades, some flowers. One photo that caught our eye is some friends on the beach at Coney Island. You can see the defunct parachute jump in the background. Another big part of Coney Island became defunct last week. Astroland closed for good last Sunday, and we talked to a photographer.
My name is Diana Taft Shoemate here at Coney Island, New York. I am also known as Ruby's Host. A friend of mine there has a place that's called Ruby's Bar and Grill. It's one of the oldest and historical bar and grills that's on the boardwalk. It's 87 years old. A lot of us had actually met there at Ruby's, just kind of hanging out, relaxing, enjoying the beach. We like being outdoors. We're all pretty active people. And this particular day, it was gorgeous. It was beautiful, bright sun, very, very clear, crystal blue sky. The guys are just hanging out. We're singing a little bit of everything from English to Spanish songs, mainly just very simple songs. So that was just kind of our way of celebrating the last of the big weekends at the beach, even though we will still be there the next few weekends. Yeah, it's very sad news that Astroland's going to be closing now after 46 years. It's very sad. We're going to miss the Scrambler. We'll miss the Bumblebee and the little long log flume ride and just walking through the park, playing the games. It's very sad.
Help us find your photos on Flickr. Make sure to tag them with Weekend America. They might just show up on our website. Go there and check those out as well from other photographers, weekendamerica.org. Great to have an upbeat song on the iPod when you go running, but what do you queue up for an ultra marathon? Listen and try to keep up next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
Going for a run this weekend? A couple of miles, maybe 5, 10 if you're really pushing it. 10 miles? Well, to Dean Karnassus, that's just adorable. You see, Dean's an ultra-marathoner. He once ran 50 marathons in 50 states in 50 days. He ran 350 miles without stopping. It took him over 80 hours. So, what does Dean listen to? Producer Gideon Darkangelo went running with Dean to find out.
We're in San Francisco, in the Presidio, the park at the base of the Golden Gate Bridge, and I'm tethered to ultramarathoner Dean Karnassus by a 6-foot audio cable. We're both wearing our headphones, and we've been running together for several miles now.
I really enjoy listening to music when I'm out on the trails, and living here in the Bay Area, I love to run up across the Golden Gate Bridge, and I love to run out into the wilderness, and that way I don't have to pay attention to traffic or anything. I can just run.
Dean does a lot of multitasking when he runs. He wrote a book by dictating it into a handheld audio recorder on his all-night runs. He's also been known to order a Hawaiian pizza with pineapple on it from Papa John's and have them deliver it to him on a street corner mid-run. And, like the rest of us, he listens to music. He queued up one of his favorite songs for us by the Chemical Brothers.
There's no lyrics in the song, but I think the music says it all. I just hear one foot in front of the other. Just keep trucking, keep moving forward. It just seems like running music.
That's huge me.
Your pace is picked up, yeah.
We snaked up through the hills above the Presidio, and I could see Alcatraz poking out of the bay in the distance. It was getting pretty hot by now, so I asked Dean, what was it like to run in the intense heat of Death Valley? It's been said the 135-mile race they run there in July pushes even extreme athletes like Dean to new places.
Did you listen to music in Death Valley?
I did. Let's find a Death Valley song. Okay, it's 114 degrees, 2 in the morning. Been running for 25 hours. There's rattlesnakes in the road, tarantulas, scorpions, no moon, shooting stars. And then I saw a 49er crossing the highway. And he had a gold pan in his hand. And he was saying, water, water. And I aspirated my water bottle in his gold pan. And I heard it sizzling on the pavement. And I realized he wasn't real. He was a hallucination. My friend said, you know what? He was a ghost. Your body can only go so far, and it's really your mind that wills you through those last miles. And I would even say it's your spirit at some point, because even your mind starts to deteriorate after that many miles.
So take me to a song in there that would kind of typifies that those moments.
The dark moments?
Well, okay.
I guess here's one I've always liked. Kind of thought of loss, sacrifice. The one thing that we kind of have confused in Western societies, we always thought if we were comfortable, we'd be happy. I think in a lot of ways we're so comfortable, we're miserable. There's just no sense of struggle in our life anymore. And to me, going out and running for 40, 50 hours straight is my way to bring back that sense of struggle and pain and working hard for something.
I never dreamed that I'd lose somebody like you. No.
What's it like running all night?
To me, it's spiritual. You know, it's my church, if you will. My time with God, you know? I think there's something to watching the sunset, the moon come up, the stars, the shooting stars, the sunrise. We don't experience that much anymore in our modern life, and I think there's a magic there. I want to play something kind of lovely. It's the next morning, it's a new awakening. To me, it kind of speaks to the act of running, how something so primitive, so simple, can be so gratifying. I never feel more alive than when I've run all night and just experience nature and push my body to the limit.
Ultramarathoner Dean Karnazes' choice of music was In Order, the Chemical Brothers, Jefferson Airplane, Chris Isaac, and this song by The Verve. You can see some photos of Dean, and you can also check out a playlist of some of our listeners' favorite workout songs, everything from Coldplay and Mates of State to Survivor. That's at weekendamerica.org. So much for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. You can download a free podcast of the show at weekendamerica.org. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe. On the next week in America, what happens when the Democratic nominee goes to Hawaii to relax?
I'm a lifeguard at Sandy Beach, and the last thing I thought I would be doing is body surfing with Barack Obama. We had a great day that day. He went out there and caught some really nice waves, had a great style, and had a good time.
Explore the island of Oahu, the childhood home and favorite getaway of Barack Obama. Join us.